It's a pleasure for me to be here, but it's also kind of scary. I was telling my wife on the way in, I'd much rather talk to 150 lay people than I would to pastors. And I guess that's because I am a pastor, and I know how I look at presenters when they present. And I assume that's exactly what's going to be happening to me this morning. And that's kind of scary in some ways. Yesterday, Dr. Steinke mentioned that he remembered something very vividly in this room from one of his classes. I have to admit to all of you that the things I remember most about the seminary happened a long ways from this room, in the gymnasium. And probably that's one of the main reasons I'm in the ministry today, is because I like to play basketball so much, and I knew that by going to the seminary, I'd get three additional years beyond what other guys in college had. And probably the one who was most influential in my life in my years here at the seminary was Coach Eldon Peterson. He was a personal role model for me of a Christian. He wasn't deeply theological. He was not that precise in all that he said, like many who are highly educated, but he lived his faith. And that had a strong impact on my life. And when I'm in small group sessions where they say, share with the group a person who had great influence in your life, many times that's the man whom I share. So much of my time was not spent in the classroom kind of setting, and that's not where my primary memories are. They're down at the gym. And if you've been down there to see some of the pictures, I did have hair at one time. My kids now, as they are growing up, end up out here on occasion. My two oldest are both graduates of Lutheran High School South, so they always play one of their games against Lutheran North out here every year in basketball. And so my kids always have to remind all their friends, yes, that really is our dad, and he did have hair at one time. So the seminary has some differing kind of memories, I'm sure, for all of us, and those are some of my primary memories. The blue sheet that you have in front of you is the topic we want to talk about this morning, and I want to give you some opportunity for response, and we will have opportunity for that as we go. Maybe it would be helpful for you to know a little bit about me beyond the seminary. When I graduated, my first assignment was to St. Martin Lutheran Church in Clintonville, Wisconsin. Pastor Simon was my neighbor at that time and not yet district president while I was there. I remember that the district president, in meeting with my wife and I and those who were called to the North Wisconsin district, set me where I was on the basis of the fact that it was 35 miles from Packer Stadium. And that was my first introduction to Wisconsin. The church was a large church. I was there for about 3 years, served as an assistant pastor, and the church had a large school. I learned a lot at that time, and my learning was both positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement, which I'm sure is true of every situation that we find ourselves in. Then after 3 years there, I got a call to Eureka, Missouri, and I've been there now for 17 years. When I came to that congregation, the congregation was worshiping in a church that seated 90 people. It was basically a holding action in the sense that it was service-oriented on Sundays and confirmation instruction. The first 23 years of its history before I came there, they had two pastors who stayed less than a total of 6 years together. So 18 years of that congregation's history was served by vacancy pastors. And Pastor Lorenz Wunderlich was vacancy pastor there for 10 years. When I came, it was an area that was beginning to grow, but had not really boomed. In fact, it still hasn't, but is right on the verge of a real explosion right now. When I came, the congregation had 100 members on the roll. We now have 1,100 members and have relocated the church. We have now a staff of 4 ministry staff people, 2 DCE trained who are in special assignments, one in evangelism and youth and the other in adult education and family life, and also serves as the principal of our Christian day school. 7 years ago, we started a Christian day school after having a preschool for 6 years. That school is exploding and growing right now, and we have 4 full-time teachers on staff, and we'll be expanding. Right now we're up through 6th grade. We will be expanding 7th and 8th grade after one more year. The congregation has grown rapidly, not just because it's in a growing area. That happens with a lot of churches. But our congregation has grown most rapidly in its past history through evangelistic outreach. In fact, to the extent that over 60% of our congregation are from non-Lutheran backgrounds. Now you need to know that because that tells you a little bit where I'm coming from when we talk about worship. That's not true of every Lutheran congregation's situation. Now, I'd like to set the scene for you just a little bit more beyond who I am and my ministry. And I'd like to share with you just a capsule of something that was taken down as notes, having heard a speaker in March of this year. And I'm just going to share these notes as a way of introduction. The world is growing at the rate of 1 million a month. The third largest language in the United States is sign language. 4% of the people in Vancouver, British Columbia go to church on Sunday. 8% in Seattle go to church. The gang population in Seattle equals the Sunday school population. Islam is the fastest growing religion in the United States. And this speaker said, because it offers brotherhood, and many of the mainline denominations offer hierarchy. Now that's just simply notes from a non-Lutheran speaker to give you a little bit of an idea of the kind of world that we are living in right now. And the reason I mention that is because it makes a difference as we look at our worship approach and what we do in worship. This speaker also had these things to say. Churches that are really ministering to people in their needs today have some of these characteristics. And the number one that he mentioned was they have creative worship with theological depth. They write their own music. They use drama and dance in appropriate ways. They intensify their caring ministries. Not just by fellowship dinners and potlucks and those kinds of things, but by different kinds of small groups, support groups, prayer groups, Bible study groups. They have a bold and dynamic mission. Part of continuing to set the scene, we are in the midst of transition to a new hymnal in our church, and some congregations are already there. So that is a factor in setting the scene. We have a new leader in our Commission on Worship, in our Synod. One of the most popular things that's going on in our Synod right now are evangelism and worship workshops that are being conducted by various pastoral leaders in our Synod, and primarily under the leadership of Dave Anderson of Barb and Dave Anderson Music Ministry, which you may be familiar with. We also are just recently somewhat aware of what happened at a conference that was called by our Synod. The first parts of May, May 2nd and 3rd, there was a conference on outreach and liturgy that was scheduled under the leadership of our Commission on Worship. And I have not seen the final report on that, but maybe you already read it in the May 15th reporter. But I'd like to just share with you what they struggled with and some of the conclusions that they briefly noted from their meeting in the reporter. And all of this is just to kind of set the scene so that as we get into a discussion about the pastor as worship leader, we'll have a little bit of a background with this information. They came out with 4 statements that were in response to 4 questions that they dealt with. And these were the questions. Who is Sunday morning worship for? Members or non-members, or both? Secondly, how does catechesis relate to worship? Thirdly, does worship need to fit expectations of American culture, or any other culture as far as that's concerned? And what role should music have in worship? Now, those were the four questions that they highlighted in the reporter that they were dealing with. And these are the four statements that they came out with from that conference. And the impression of the reporter is that these were agreed upon. Now, I don't know any more about it than that. I'm just reporting what's here in the reporter. Here's the conclusions. Number one, Sunday morning worship is for everybody who comes. Now, I'd like to know more about that when they make that statement. We would all probably agree, sure, anybody that walks through that door is welcome, right? But I think we have to ask further than that. Who is the target audience? And then how do we reach that target audience? Not just everybody's welcome. But that was their conclusion, that Sunday morning is for everybody who comes. Second, in answer to the question, how does catechesis relate to worship? Catechesis, which is training in the basic teachings of the church, and worship are closely connected, since the teaching builds and amplifies what we understand in Scripture as reflected in Luther's small catechism. Thought that was an interesting point, in that I don't see in our traditional approaches to worship a lot of direct relationship to the small catechism, and yet that was the conclusion that they drew. And I'm not saying that's wrong or right. I'm just saying I would have never answered it that way, that the small catechism is interwoven into all of our worship. Certainly it's there, but I wouldn't have concluded it that way. In response to the third question, does worship need to fit expectations of American culture? Their answer, while the gospel is always proclaimed within a culture and transforms that culture, the cultural setting should not be allowed to change the gospel's content. I'm sure we would all agree with that. But I think we still have to ask a harder question. How are we conveying that unchanging gospel content to those who come for worship? And then the fourth point in response to the question, what role should music have in worship? Music, they say, that communicates the gospel is so important that it requires great care and significant planning to employ styles that are appropriate to the worshiping community. And I thought that last phrase was very interesting. Worship music styles that are appropriate to the worshiping community. And I would really like to pursue that further with them also. If they really mean that, then I think we have to look at some things beyond what I perceive we are looking at today. Now, that's kind of a lot of background, but I think it's helpful for you to kind of know some of that and some of where I'm coming from. We, at the outset, I believe, need to say that if we are serious about our ministry of reaching the lost and the great potential ever increasing for that ministry, we've got to look at our worship services in that light. If we are reaching out to people, for most people, one of the first, if not the first, and one of the primary contacts they have with our congregations are in what we would refer to as the public worship service. Now, that may not be their first contact with our ministry. It might be through one of our members who has witnessed to them and brought them. It might be through one of our ministry programs, our Christian Day School, Vacation Bible School, something like that. But their contact with the entire congregation, and in many ways the impression they will get from that gathered body, is centered in the worship service on Sunday morning. Now, if that's all true to any extent, we need to ask some helpful questions about the pastor as worship leader. On the sheet, what is worship? I suppose we could put you into small groups and everybody could talk about that. There is a wide range of definition here. I remember in my class on worship at the seminary, and I think it probably came out more in my pastoral theology class, and I think it muddied the waters for me. We talked about worship as a whole way of life. And indeed, that's true, but that doesn't really help me understand what we normally refer to as worship on Sunday morning. Worship is a word that comes from the Anglo-Saxon derivative that means to attribute worth to something. If you look at Psalm 96, verse 8, you'll see that the psalmist says, our God is worthy of our praise. If you look at Revelation 5, verse 12, you'll see the heavenly worship service singing a song which says, "Worthy is the Lamb to receive glory and power and wisdom and honor." That worthiness is really the derivative of our concept of worship. And even though it is all of life, what we are dealing with this morning is what we call the Sunday morning worship service. A couple of other things that came to my mind that maybe we need to highlight in this regard is that worship is a verb. And sometimes we, and I'm going to deal with this in some of the upcoming portion here, is sometimes that we have dealt with worship as something that we go to get something. When in actuality, the concept of worship as a verb is that we go to participate and to get involved, to give in that sense. I believe that what we have allowed to happen, in some ways at least, is we've allowed worship to become clergy-oriented so that people perceive it, whether we say it or not, people perceive it as the pastor performing. And perhaps it has been even made more difficult because of the television syndrome of our society, where we sit in front of a television set to receive. We don't get involved at all. And we've sort of imposed that on the worship service. And perhaps in some ways, the worship leader has succumbed to that pressure and have become performers. And all of us could probably cite examples of that. The television preachers are probably the most classic things that come to our minds, and we see them as entertaining. Now, the gospel certainly is there, or should be there, but the format is often the performer kind of thing. Worship is to get involved. When we go to worship, I thought about this in regard to what we do to our own kids at home. And in my preparations, I haven't had a chance to talk to my wife about this, but I think we're going to talk about this with our kids in a little different light. When we go to worship, many times we come home and with the kids we say, "What'd you get out of the service this morning?" Now, that's not a bad question, but it places the emphasis on you went as a consumer and somebody was supposed to give you something. Now, tell me what you got. Maybe a better question would be, "How'd you do this morning? You know, how'd you worship this morning? How'd you get involved?" Now, maybe that's kind of a fine line, but I think we enhance the concept of non-involvement too much. We might also call worship an act of remembrance, the enactment of the gospel. One of the Hebrew concepts of remembering is not just to recall the facts, but to get involved in what took place. And in that sense, worship as a verb of remembrance is very helpful. To get involved in salvation history and to see yourself in that picture, dying with Christ, rising with Him, and the whole baptism concept is a beautiful opportunity. Now, if worship is any of that at all, one of the things that it requires is that we be prepared to worship properly. Starts with the leader in terms of leading worship, but it's true for everyone, and we need to help our people get ready for worship. I put in a quote there from Søren Kierkegaard, and I thought it was kind of helpful in the light of what we're talking about and in the basic root meanings of the word worship. In Christian worship, God is the audience, the congregation the performer, and the minister, choir, and other leaders are the prompters. Now think of that in those terms, because I'm going to use that terminology as we proceed. I want you to just kind of brainstorm with me, and we're going to try to avoid right and wrong answers this morning. There's not right answers or wrong answers. There's different ways of looking at this concept in the way we're going to be talking about it this morning. There are right and wrong answers, obviously, but not in regard to this. But in your mind, what makes for a worship service? Now, the reason I ask the question is, if you look in the Bible, it's awfully hard to find a worship service like we do it. But there are ingredients that are part of God's people gathering together in response to His action in Jesus Christ. So what in your mind are some of the necessary ingredients to constitute a worship service? Let's just list them all. Prayer. Praise.
Word and sacrament.
Psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. That's the way Paul says it in Colossians.
Proclaiming the gospel.
Declaration, proclamation. Anything else?
Sacrifice.
We talk in terms of the sacrificial dimension of the service.
Fellowship.
Anything else? Confession of sins. Absolution. Okay, the physical setting, the attitude in which people arrive for worship and participate. Okay.
The offering,
yes. We had to include that, didn't we? Yes. Definitely.
Yeah.
A meaningful liturgy, okay? Now, we're getting a little beyond, you know, basic ingredients. One other thing that maybe we didn't say, but an opportunity for confession of faith, not only confession of sins, but a confession of faith. And what we have done in many ways is we've formalized all of that. And that's not wrong, but is it the only way to do it, or are there other things to consider in that regard? Now, probably what we listed are the basic ingredients of worship, and you could find those in various sections of the Bible. I put down the biblical pattern just in regard to the New Testament primarily. In Acts 2, verse 42, this is right after the Pentecost outpouring of the Holy Spirit in that very special way. It's after Peter's sermon when the people said, after they were cut to the heart, what shall we do? And he said, be baptized, repent, and every one of you, and you will receive the forgiveness of sins, and you will also receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. And then the description of what happened in their life together after that is the remainder of Acts chapter 2. Now, I put down just the one passage here, but you need to look at it in the context of the whole. There are four ingredients that are noted there in Acts 2:42 that consume their time together. Now, where'd they meet? Well, in verse 46, it says they met regularly in the temple. In the Concordia Self-Study Bible, they refer you back in that passage in Acts 2:46. They refer you back to Luke 24:53. And then they describe it there, and this is what they say in here. They describe it there as they probably used one of the many rooms at the temple as a place to gather. And I'm concluding from that they know what they're talking about, and it's probably not akin to what we would think of the temple as a worship area, because the temple probably wasn't that in the sense that we worship today. So it was a gathering. Now, if you start defining what makes a gathering of God's people a worship service, we got into an interesting discussion at our circuit conference a couple of months ago, and I think it illustrates the point that I'm trying to make here. One of the points that was made in the discussion was that women should not speak in the worship service, but they could lead Bible classes. Now, I know not everybody agreed with that either, but just for the sake of the point. Then we began to press the person who made that statement, and we said, when is it not a Bible class, and when is it a worship service? And then he began to describe numbers. When it reaches a certain number, it's a worship service. And when it has lesser numbers, it's a Bible class. Now, if you really start thinking, how are you going to define the difference between a gathering of Christians who share the word, a prayer meeting, whatever we might call it, and a worship service, you start making some very arbitrary kinds of distinctions. And so in the Bible, what you have is God's people gathering together and certain things they shared there. Now in Acts 2:42, I put a little statement in there underneath that. What they shared was word and sacrament surrounded by prayer and fellowship. Probably they met in people's homes. That's the indication of the early Christian church. And when they were gathered together, they shared word and sacrament. They probably shared more than the Lord's Supper. They probably had regular potluck dinners, and maybe that's where we got the idea in the Lutheran Church. But the breaking of bread was more than the Lord's Supper, but that certainly was a part of it. They gathered around word and sacrament, and there were two other key ingredients that are highlighted here that they devoted themselves to: fellowship and prayer. Now, we mentioned all of those when we said what are the ingredients that go into a worship service, but we added some others. And that's not right or wrong, it just means that the biblical pattern, this was their focus. What I ask myself, and what I think we need to ask ourselves, is how does our worship service contribute to this kind of a gathering? Certainly we have word and sacrament, no doubt about that. But what about the fellowship dimension? What kind of fellowship dimensions are incorporated into our worship? And what form does prayer take? How personal is it? How much is it a performance rather than a participation? And those are some hard questions. I have more questions this morning than I have answers for you. But I think I want to help you pose the questions that I struggle with. Now, what does this worship involve? I've put four things down there, and I'm just going to list these off real quickly. Worship involves coming to God. As part of our response, we come to God at His invitation by the working of His Spirit. Secondly, worship involves hearing God speak to us, and that might be with the spoken word, but it might also be with the visible, tangible word of baptism and the Lord's Supper. But we come to God and we listen to God. Thirdly, we commune with God and with each other. The strong biblical thread that runs throughout the Scriptures is that God is above everything and has a personal relationship with us, His people. But in that personal relationship, we're not there by ourselves. We're there with everyone else with whom He has a personal relationship. The whole body concept. And this is where the concept of fellowship fits in very really. We enter into communion with Him. And then the fourth dimension of worship that I'd like to share with you is that we are sent forth. Now, how does our worship send people forth for ministry? Why that pattern works is on the back side of your sheet. And I will move through this also, just giving you some points. Why does that kind of pattern work, if that is a legitimate pattern? Number one, it provides a helpful, now underline that word helpful, and you're getting Darwin Carsten here. You're not going to find any great depth of theology in terms of something that I'm of an axe I'm grinding. I'm simply sharing with you from the heart, and I hope that's what you anticipate in a gathering like this. Number one, a helpful meeting between God and His people. A helpful meeting. Now, a certain amount of form is necessary for a helpful meeting. It's true when we meet each other, as you've met friends here today. There was some sort of form in your meeting. You said, hello. You said, good morning. You said, how are things going? Where are you at now? How many people do you have in your family? Where's your congregation? What kind of congregation is it? We have a form in which we come together with others. And so it's important to have a form in which we come together with God. The departure is much the same way. With people, we say goodbye, or we say the Lord bless your day, or some other kind of departure, and we repeat those things regularly. Whenever you prepare something like this, it makes you think about yourself. And I thought about myself in terms of how unoriginal I am when I meet people. Now, we repeat it every time. Look at yourself sometime. You have a pattern that may be different than my pattern of the way you greet people. How you doing? You know, howdy, partner. You know, I mean, it depends on the area of country, too. But we keep repeating it, and the form allows us to have a helpful meeting. The form for worship allows us to have a helpful meeting with God. And I emphasize the helpful because that really is what needs to happen when we come together with God. If we aren't helped, if we aren't given hope, then we're kind of wasting our time, it would seem to me. Now, certainly it's the gospel that does that, but our gathering should be filled with that kind of helpful meeting, God with his people. Second thing that the biblical kind of pattern we've been talking about allows is that it reflects the priesthood of all believers. I don't know the full history of worship, but my perception is that one of the things the Reformation spoke against was a clergy-dominated church that was also a clergy-centered worship approach. And one of the things that I hear Luther doing in writing his catechisms and in other ways is he wanted to get the word of the Lord personal to people. And he wanted the worship also to be worship of the people. Maybe what we have and continue to struggle against is the tendency to drift back into that pre-Reformation, clergy-centered church and clergy-centered worship. And if this is to be an opportunity to really build on the priesthood of all believers, we need to look at that in that light. And seek to overcome the audience mentality, which is conditioned by television, where the whole community needs to be involved. Now, as I said, I have a lot more questions than answers. We try to do that at St. Mark's in various ways, and I'll share those with you as we continue today. But we don't have all the answers. We continue to struggle with that. How do we enhance the priesthood of all believers and a meaningful meeting with God in our worship? The third item is the tension between order and freedom. We need freedom to be spontaneous. God is personal, and he touches every life in a very personal way. And though the message of the gospel is the same and it never changes, it means something different to me in different situations because of my need. And so there needs to be a form, but there also needs to be some freedom in there. An opportunity for spontaneous response to what God has to say. Now, immediate thing that comes to our mind are the holiness groups or the charismatics who we tend to think respond spontaneously in a wrong way. But on the other extreme, we have formalized all response so that we don't allow or encourage any kind of spontaneity. Now, how do you walk the balance? Another question that I have, which is, again, one of those more questions than answers. We've all been to different worship services, and as my wife tells me, as a pastor, I'm a horrible participant because many times I struggle against, am I here to be fed or am I here to evaluate? And I know none of you are that way. I'm only sharing my honesty. I've been in churches where the liturgy was all there. It was proper. But there was an atmosphere of lifelessness. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not talking at all about any kind of demeaning of the work of the Spirit. I'm not talking about that. I am totally convinced that the Spirit of God works through the Word, and there's no other way. I have no concept in my ministry of people's involvement, no synergistic concepts. It is God alone. And if you don't believe that, you ask my congregation, they'll tell you that. That's the message. But I've been in churches where the word was there, the liturgy was there, the proclamation was there, it was theologically accurate, But there was a lifeless atmosphere, a lack of excitement, no opportunity for spontaneity in any sense. The simplest smile on the face was inappropriate. But it was all right. And then I've been in other churches that did exactly the same thing. But there was a spirit of fellowship. There was a spirit of anticipation and excitement. Now I realize those are human observations, and the Spirit of God is working in both instances. But I know that if I'm a new person, if I'm just new in the Christian faith, if I am looking for a home, I will have much greater tendency to come back to the one where there was an atmosphere of life than to the other one where there wasn't. Now that becomes a very human kind of consideration. But it is reality also, brothers and sisters. We are dealing with reality here also. And the questions we ask about worship have to be asked in that light also. Let me share with you some concerns of the prompters, and I'm going to finish the whole thing and then give you opportunity to ask your questions so that we don't get too far sidetracked, which I think this topic will have a tendency to do. As I share with you these seven words, again, I'm sharing from the heart, things that have become important to me and things which I have sought to carry out in my ministry at St. Mark's. And as I share these 7 points with you, I want you to think about 4 things in relation to each one of them. Number 1, the order of the service. Number 2, the musical involvement. I suppose this varies from church to church to some extent, but about 40% of our traditional worship is music. So that's a pretty key factor. The third thing I'd like to have you think about in terms of these 7 words is the leader, the liturgist, the worship leader. We don't call our worship leaders liturgists because nobody knows what that means. We call them worship leaders. And the 4th thing I want you to watch for is the preacher, the proclamation. Now, I know Dr. Mollering shared with you about preaching yesterday, and we're not going to primarily focus on that in any way, but it is certainly an integral part of our worship. If you look at Hebrews chapter 10, if you have your Bibles, look at this. Hebrews chapter 10, beginning with verse 22. Let me just share with you, I think, an interesting presentation of what we're talking about in terms of the biblical record. Beginning with verse 22 of Hebrews 10, "Let us draw near to God with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience, and having our bodies washed with pure water." That talks about the importance of preparation, talks about the importance of a heart attitude as you come to worship, and we need to cultivate that. Verse 23, "Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful." We have a sure and certain word from a sure and certain God. That doesn't change. But then the writer goes on to say, "And let us consider." Now, I think the concept there is, let's think about this in terms of what will be most effective. I don't think that's stretching it. Let us consider. We have a sure and certain hope. It's really an attitude of our heart, but now let's talk about what happens most effectively when we get together. Let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds. Remember, we said one of the ingredients that I suggested for you is to be sent forth. How can we spur one another on to greater Christian living? Verse 25, "Let us not give up meeting together." It's important. Fellowship is introduced there. "As some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another." The whole concept of building up, of support. Let us encourage one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. The difficulties of the times are also highlighted in that section. Now, it seems to me that what the writer to the Hebrews is highlighting are the things we're talking about. Now, how do the prompters, remember the prompters are the minister, the choir, and other leaders in Kierkegaard's definition, how do the prompters help this happen? And what are some of the ingredients? I have seven of them there, and let me just highlight them for you, and then make your notes and your comments, because I want to hear them and I want to hear your questions. Number one, we need to think in terms of our worship being a corporate experience. Now, what do we mean by that? There should be, as we gather together, a strong sense of belonging. This is where I should be. The community concept, the fellowship concept of Acts 2:42. This is my family. You know you're in the right place. Now, when I give illustrations of our congregation, I'm not holding our congregation up in any kind of way that we've got it all together, because we don't. We've got more problems than any of your congregations. But one of the things that I find happening many times, not just once or twice, but many times with people who visit our church, they will say something like, "The minute I walked in, I felt home. The minute I walked in, I found what I've been looking for." I have a pastor who's a member of our congregation who came from another Lutheran church and resigned from the ministry and is now a member of our congregation. He said that he had been looking for a church for a long time. He came from a Lutheran church that was very rigid. I won't tell you which one. But it was on the right side, not on the left side. Okay? And he felt like the church was very legalistic and law-oriented. He came to our church after visiting a bunch of different churches, and he has told me, without prompting, that the day he walked into our church, he had found what he'd been looking for all his life. And as I pursue that with him, what he's talking about is, I felt at home. This was family. It was a corporate experience for him. So we need to be concerned that we make it the best possible corporate experience. Secondly, our worship should be therapeutic. Yesterday, when Dr. Steinke pointed out his newsletter, and he said in one of them he had an article about liturgy as therapeutic. You remember when he said that? And some of you probably saw me come running up here and get a copy of that when he said there weren't many copies. It wasn't because I'm one of those people that always pushes to the front of the line. It's just that I thought if I was going to be talking about that today and I had this word down already, I better know what he was talking about so that I wasn't clear off in left field. What I mean by therapeutic is that the worship service should be upbuilding. It should give help and hope to people. If we're not helping people, and that can be all the way across the range of people's needs, it can be, and I think we need to consider this also, that a person coming to our worship may not know the Lord. They may not be a believer. And one of the ways that our service should be therapeutic is that we bring them the sweet message of the gospel for salvation. But that's not the only possible help or hope it might give. It's across the whole range of needs. It needs to be therapeutic, and that's what the article said in Dr. Steinke's newsletter. And he highlighted the fact that much of our liturgy has wholeness in it. The word peace, from the Hebrew derivative shalom, really means may everything be well with you. May your whole life be well. May you be whole. And that message comes through a lot in our worship. The greeting, the peace of the Lord be with you. The blessing, the dismissal at the Lord's Supper. How often the word peace comes. And our worship services need to be therapeutic. They need to be uplifting, upbuilding, healing. There's no value in knowledge for knowledge's sake. Now, I don't know what the discussion was at that conference the first part of this month where they concluded that catechesis and the parts of the catechism are integrated into worship. But I would want to ask the question beyond that. Is it incorporated as knowledge for knowledge's sake? Or is it incorporated in a way that is therapeutic? But it's knowledge for knowledge's sake. Now, I don't know what the discussion was at that conference the first part of this month, where they concluded that catechesis and the parts of the catechism are integrated into worship. But I would want to ask the question beyond that. Is it incorporated as knowledge for knowledge's sake? Or is it incorporated in a way that is therapeutic, that is helpful and healing? The third dimension is warmth, a feeling of welcome. The suspicion that I have is that we operate, whether we say it or not, in many ways, not expecting anyone to be at our worship services except lifelong members of a Lutheran church. We don't give directions, what page we're on. We assume that we print it in the bulletin and that's enough. And I really question whether people can feel warm if they're uncomfortable. The whole idea of warmth begins by the way they're welcomed at the service. I have a real struggle with some of our ushers. We could have a cigar store Indian standing there and accomplishing the same thing that some of our ushers accomplish. Now they're just going to hand out the bulletin, you know. But the first impression of many people is either by the ushers or the greeters. Some churches have a higher system, a higher organized system of greeting people, even on the parking lots. But the first impression of the church is many times given by the first person they run into. Maybe the person that honks at them because they took the parking space that they were planning to drive into. You know, there's a lot of things that go into warmth in terms of worship. It also is the way the worship service is conducted. Is there a real sense of welcome? Not only verbally spoken, but acted out throughout the service. Now, some of this is dependent upon the leader, but a lot of it is dependent upon the whole congregation. And so there is a need for the leader to convey the importance of that kind of warmth in our worship setting affected by them. The fourth item is that the service should be passionate. Now you wonder where I'm going with that one, right? The concept is from the Greek word pathos, empathy. Deep, bowel-wrenching concern for people. Is that the message that comes through in our worship services, that we really care about people? A lot of that is dependent in the service structure itself upon the demeanor and the approach of the leader and the preacher. But do we really have an empathy for people and have them as our highest concern? Such empathy comes from the Spirit, and we ought to pray for it. I heard a speaker 17 years ago say something that has stuck in my mind from that point to this day. And he was talking about leading worship, ironically enough. And he said, make sure, as the leader, you're prayed up. Now, that could be interpreted in some negative ways, charismatically and all of that, but I interpreted it in my personal life that I pray for my worship leading and my preaching so that these kinds of ingredients will come through in the worship service. Now, those three items there, 2, 3, and 4, I want to just add a thought. If those are present in the worship service, but are not backed up by other ministries in the church, they will also fall flat. If people don't know they're cared for, they're loved, that there is a therapeutic offering throughout the ministry of the entire congregation, then if that just happens in the worship service, it will be rather empty. This brings to mind some things that are probably very near and dear to me. I didn't tell you that I'm one of the pastoral members of Synod's Board for Evangelism, and so probably some of the things that are coming through in that regard you will understand a little better. But if those things are not backed up in our ministry, things like assimilating new members so that they are welcomed and involved and not slipping out the back door, things like the ministries of caring. What kind of ministries of caring do you have? One of the biggest fallacies of a congregation is to say it will just happen, or the pastor will do it all. It won't happen. You need to have an intentional structure of caring for people. And I know that this has different reactions in different people's minds, but I want to tell you from the heart again, one of the things that has helped me and our ministry tremendously is the Stephen series. I went to the leadership training a couple of months ago here in St. Louis, and I learned a lot about myself and my caring ministry. Most people would refer to me as a caring pastor if you ask the members of my congregation over the years. But I really didn't care for them like they need to be cared for, and I learned that, and it was helpful. So those kinds of ministries need to back up this kind of an atmosphere in the worship service. That pathos and empathy, I have to share a kind of a lighthearted illustration with you. Last week, it's a little over a week ago now, one of the 31-year-old members of our congregation, a husband and father, had been having some strange behavior. And I got involved with the situation, and we felt that it would be indicated that he would go to a counselor. I referred him to a Christian counselor with his wife, feeling that it was stress and depression kinds of relationships. He went to the counselor that I suggested, who was a psychologist, and the psychologist determined that it was severe enough that he needed medication, so he referred him to a psychiatrist so that the medication could be given. The psychiatrist saw that it was severe enough. He felt he ought to be put into the stress unit of the hospital, and they admitted him on Sunday. Tuesday, they did a brain scan and found a brain tumor. He went into a coma Tuesday night and died Wednesday morning. Now, that was a real trauma in our ministry. But the little boy, his oldest little boy, is 6 years old. And in ministry to that young man, he knew me as pastor and he knew me as caring, and that came through. And the only contact he has with me is on Sunday morning, besides through the conversation of his parents. You can imagine the trauma of that situation, a 31-year-old dying that quickly at the funeral. The family was all seated, and I came into the church for the service, and the little boy was sitting in the front row. And as I walked up to the altar, Ben said, "Hi, Pastor." Now, to me, that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. He had that kind of relationship because he saw it, and the primary place he saw it was in worship. Because I don't teach a Sunday school class. That's the warmth. That's the winsomeness that I believe our worship services need to convey. Number 5, unconventional. What do I mean by that? I believe people listen differently in every age. That the gospel does not change, but the medium through which the gospel is proclaimed or shared needs to be a medium that people can hear. Now, we don't have problems with that in terms of a deaf person needing sign language. We say, well, obviously, through the sign language. We don't have a problem with that when people are Spanish and they only speak Spanish. We put it into Spanish. But we seem to have real problems with dealing with what's the best medium of communication when it comes to changing our English order of service. Now, again, that's a question more than an answer. But is it the best way to convey to people the message of the gospel, the unchanging message of the gospel? We need to ask that question more honestly than we do. And yet at the same time be respectful of tradition. I'm not saying throw out traditional things, but I'm saying do we make decisions about our orders of worship only on the basis of tradition? Sixthly, I believe that worship ought to be dynamic. It ought to stir, and it ought to inspire, and it ought to motivate people to action. I always remember, I'm seeing Pee Wee Stelzer brings back all my days at Fort Wayne and basketball and all the athletics that I was involved in as I went to school. I remember coaches giving a pep talk in the locker room so that we really wanted to go out there and play. Shouldn't our worship be that way? Shouldn't our worship motivate and inspire us in a celebrative kind of atmosphere so that we'd go out there and do it for the Lord? Why is our church reluctant to witness, to really share? There's a lot of factors, but one of them is our approach to worship. I've had people tell me after I conduct evangelism workshops, and I'm only sharing with you what they have said, Pastor, we love to share our faith with people, but we really don't feel comfortable inviting anybody to our church because the worship service doesn't convey to them the same excitement that we shared with them in their home when we witnessed to Christ. And that's kind of sad. It ought to be celebrative and dynamic and motivating and inspiring so that people will want to serve the Lord as they serve others. And the last point is it needs to be comfortable, uncomplicated, easy to follow. The KISS principle, keep it simple, saint. I went to a church on a vacation trip right after the new hymnal came out. And I didn't know much about the new hymnal, and I was a Lutheran pastor. And I went to that worship service, and I have to tell you, I did not know where we were at 3/4 of the time. Now you can ask me what I remember from that service, and I can tell you that part. Ask me what the pastor preached on, I can't tell you that. Because I was spending all my time paging through the hymnal trying to find where he was at next. It reminded me of when we were in Australia. In Australia, they have the Lutheran Church of Australia's hymnal, and we went over there in 1976 to conduct evangelism clinics, and we attended their services. Of all the Sundays I attended their services, I can tell you with all honesty, I still don't know what page they were on. To this day. And I have a copy of their hymnal that they gave me to bring back with me, and I still don't know where they were. And I'll never forget my first experience. We went into this church, and the tradition in Australia, at least at this church, was that the pastor came out, and the first thing that was spoken was the invocation. And everybody instantly stood up. And I didn't know I was supposed to stand up, so I was late. And I wondered what everybody was thinking. And when I stood up, I didn't realize that as I had slid into the pew, that when I stood up, there was a banner hanging here, and it hit me about right here. And I could not see the front. And then instantly after he spoke the invocation, you know, in our churches, we think about being up for a while, right? He said, in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, everybody sat down. I was late again. And I wasn't comfortable. I didn't feel comfortable in that setting because I didn't know what was going on. Now, here's a little Carstenism. I believe that if people are uncomfortable, they won't come back again. I mean, I don't have to put myself in an uncomfortable position. Is that what you plan to do in your life? You keep putting yourself in one uncomfortable position after another? I don't think we do that, and I don't think people do that. And so our services need to be comfortable. They need to be clear. People need to know what's happening. At St. Mark's, what we do is we print out the service in the bulletin, and we staple the pages in, and we allow no inserts. Now, why do we do all that? To make people feel comfortable. When you put inserts in a bulletin, and the usher hands it to somebody, what's the first thing that happens? All the inserts fall out on the floor. If you got a visitor that does that, what kind of impression do they have? Discomfort. Or if they get into the service and they made it with all the inserts, and the first thing they do is open up the bulletin to find out where you're at, and all the inserts fall out, they know everybody in the church is looking at them. Or if they don't know what page the service is on, if they don't have a clear conception of where you're going, if the service isn't formed in such a way that they say, now I know what's going on, and I know what this is going, where this is going, and I can feel comfortable in that. When people are uncomfortable, I believe they don't come back. I have to tell you an experience that I had about a year ago. A family visited our church. This family has three little children, and they're from a Baptist background, but they'd heard about our church having just moved into the area, and they visited us, and by the way, they're now members, having gone through my adult confirmation class, and are actively involved in our congregation. I made the evangelism visit on their home the Sunday after they visited. Now, let me tell you the setting. I wasn't there that Sunday. So when I made the evangelism call, I could go incognito. And I do that whenever I can. I introduced myself simply as Darwin Karsten, you know, and they probably don't remember seeing that name in the bulletin and all that kind of thing. The first thing they said to me, before I said anything else, except that I was from St. Mark's Lutheran Church, the first thing they said to me, oh, we really enjoyed worship at your church last Sunday because the bulletin was all printed out and we could follow what was going on. And when we got home, we could go over it again with our children. Unsolicited. But they saw it as a helpful kind of thing for their worship experience. And they were comfortable. And they came back. I wasn't even there, so I didn't do it. I wrote the service before I left, but I was out of town that weekend, and somebody else did it. But that's what they noted, the very first thing they said to me. We're never going to do it perfectly, and I don't think we have a perfect order of service yet. But we as human beings in a sinful world with our human weaknesses need to ask some good questions that will help us do it better. Pastor, as worship leader, we have about 15 minutes for you to respond. And I want your honest input. I've gotten blasted for saying these things before, so, you know, I'm aware. Any thoughts? I got a thing about that. I remember the first time that I was at the seminary, and that's where I first encountered the passing of the king. And I was sitting next to my fellow students and friends. And when the professor said, "Now turn to the person next to you and say, 'The peace of the Lord be with you,' I wanted to crawl into the pew. You know, and I was sitting next to people I knew. So I'm really careful about that, not putting people, you know, that. Take the hand of the person next to you. I just got a thing about that, and that's me. There's nothing wrong with it, but I really am overly sensitive to asking people to do something that they're not comfortable with. I remember when I was first in the ministry, if it was a contemporary service, if you passed the peace. Nothing else changed, but it was contemporary if you passed the peace. So that was my experience. That's what I think.
Different
order of service every Sunday? Yes.
How different?
What,
do you follow the
liturgy? Yes. Do all of that. I'm putting myself on the line here so that you understand. I'm willing to share with you from the heart. I write the service every Sunday, not always from scratch, but from the theme that we're pursuing so that it's integrated. And then I will either write certain portions or I will find them in resources like the worship supplement or the hymnal or the Australian hymnal, believe it or not.
if you print it in the bulletin, you don't have to find it in the hymnal, you know, and you know that. And then we will just integrate the service that way. One of the things, and this is my approach, is that I use what is probably totally unliturgical, and it's really a substitute for what we traditionally call the intro. I use, in 90% of my services, what I call a call to worship. And 90% of the time, the call to worship is responsive quotation of Scripture that lends to the thrust of the sermon or the message of the service. And that's a typical pattern for us. And then we don't do radical things. I'd be happy to share any bulletin that anybody wanted to see. It's not radical. It includes all the ingredients that you said make up a worship service, remember? All the things include that, but doesn't include it in the form that's in the front of the hymnal every Sunday. We may use portions of the hymnal, and we may not use the hymnal at all in terms of the order of worship on a given Sunday. So,
quick question.
Yeah.
What do you do with the insert?
Put them into the bulletin. Somebody sends us an insert from Lutheran Bible Translators. We run it through our Xerox and throw away all the inserts that they gave us and run it into the bulletin. Yeah, it goes on a page. There's only full pages in the bulletin. My secretary gets a little upset with me at times because I go beyond. You know, there can either, with the front and back of the bulletin taken, there can either be 6 or 10, and sometimes I have 7. And she knows that you don't put a half sheet in the bulletin either, so she's scrambling for inserts of all kinds. You know, but we do that. That's just the thing. We staple it, and there's one piece. It won't come apart, and that's what people work out of for worship.
How about music? Do you print that out, and what kind of music do you use?
Basically, we use the hymnal music. We are very sensitive to copyright laws. And so rarely, unless it's in the public domain area, will we print anything in a bulletin. And we try to be sensitive to that. But we use the hymnal. We have the old hymnal. And the 41 hymnal. Not the Lutheran Church of Australia. We have the old 41 hymnal still in our congregation. For two reasons. One, we just bought new hymnals 10 years ago, and they're very good shape. And I don't think it's good stewardship to not use them. That's one reason. Number two is, the new hymnal doesn't add any more to what we do than the old hymnal does. And that's not negative on the new hymnal, I'm just saying that's where we're at. And then we also have in the pew a hymnal called Hymns for the Living Church. And one of the things we also do on a given Sunday is we only sing out of one hymnal. You know, I shuffle them. You get one hymnal out, that we use for the whole service, and you put it away. Yeah?
I'd like to express my thanks to you for a stimulating and challenging presentation. I can identify with very many of your concerns and some of your suggested solutions. One thing I'd like to ask about, I'm a longtime Kierkegaard fan, but I'm wondering, in Christian worship, God is the audience. As I see it, our tradition has been, and I believe correctly, contextually, that the pivotal point of worship are word and sacrament. Now, how is God the audience in regard to word and sacrament, those are key ingredients of our worship?
There are both there. And any time you put a quotation in, and after I put it in, I thought, all these guys are much smarter than I am. And, you know, I probably will regret this. I am not going to defend Kierkegaard's comment. I think the point I wanted to draw from it, certainly word and sacrament is God speaking to us. No doubt about it. That's God acting toward us. But then the worship becomes a response to what God does in us. And that's what I saw Kierkegaard emphasizing, is the responsive nature of worship, even though the stimulation for that response in word and sacrament is also there. I didn't read it from him as denying that dimension, but simply highlighting the fact that people ought to be involved in worship directed towards God. You know, that's all I could tell you about that. I don't know any more about that than that.
You know, when I read that first time, I didn't believe I just read it. God is there.
And I guess I like the prompter part too. That's why I also chose that. You know, that the leader or the pastor is not the performer, but the prompter to get people involved in worship.
I think in connection with that, well, the German word for worship is Gottesdienst. And I think the God action in that is important. And I think that's where some of the tension might come in, where, you know, the whole idea of clergy domination, we see ourselves as servants of the presence of Him who is the invisible one. And then there, the whole concept of word and passion do dominate. I think that's how we see theology.
Yeah. And I don't disagree with that at all. I hope you understand, you hear me loud and clear. A word and sacrament is central. And again, come to St. Mark's and you ask people what happens on Sunday morning, they'll tell you word and sacrament. That's what happens. But word and sacrament with the goal of sending people out to live and to serve the Lord, and that the atmosphere in which that is done has a marked effect on what happens after they leave that worship service. Way in the back. Another one of my little quirks, we put visitor red ribbons on them and have people look for them, and I say that in the service, to greet the people with the badges, especially, greet one another, but we don't have them stand. And I got to think about that too. I visited Chuck Swindoll's church. I'll just show you what happened to us. I visited Chuck Swindoll's church when we were in California 2 years ago, just to see what happened there. And by the way, it wasn't a big deal. You know, I thought it was a big deal. People are beating down the doors. We got there. Let me tell you a little bit more about it. We got there at 7:30 because we thought the service was at 8. The service was at 9. And as we drove on the parking lot, we met one of the members walking across the parking lot and asked that question. You know what she said to me? If you don't think there's an attitude, atmosphere, relationship here? She said to me, oh no, the service doesn't start till 9 o'clock, but you better get a parking place now if you want one. That's an hour and a half before the service. How many people in your congregation would tell you that? And they had a big parking lot. You know, we weren't talking about a little parking lot. We were talking about a big parking lot, you know. Then when we got in there, they have a place in the worship where they say the doors will now be closed. No one can enter anymore. And when we left, there were people lined up for the next service because they didn't get into the first one. And the service wasn't that big a deal. I mean, Swindoll's a good communicator, but they had a choir, they had an orchestra, they had some music, they had soloists, they had scripture reading, and then he taught for 45 minutes. That was it. But they're beating down the doors to come there. And it was very simple. I mean, extremely simple. If a 60-piece orchestra is simple, but you know, it was simple in the sense that the order was very, very simple.
Do you teach the congregation new songs, or do you, and if you do, how do you do it outside of this, you know, do you just use what's in the bulletin, do you use an overhead projector, or how do you do that, and do you recommend that quite often? One thing that, when I'm a visitor, it frustrates me not to hear a Lutheran congregation sing, but people sing.
A couple of suggestions. I'll talk about this a little bit more this afternoon. Get yourself a music director and use them at least on occasion to direct the congregation. That's one thing. Secondly, in teaching new hymns, we try to get the choir to be there when we do that so that they have a stronger voice in leading hymns. Thirdly, I'm a stickler on this, is that I don't print out just words of hymns very often in the bulletin. Why? Because there's an assumption there that everybody present will know the melody. You ever been in a service where you got one of the new hymns out of a new hymnal that you'd never sung before, and it was in a printed order service, and all of there the words. How'd you feel? Uncomfortable, huh? The other question, the other point that relates to that is you have to be really careful about copyright. And we break copyright laws all the time. Not St. Mark's, but we generally. If you want to get strict, we're breaking them all the time. But there are ways that we have found that you can not violate copyright laws and still introduce new hymns, but you have to pay some money to do it. You have to get on certain available services that will cost you a couple hundred dollars a year to use all of the publishing companies that are under that service. And that's what we're in the process of doing. Yeah, they're legitimate. It's just that you can use whatever is under their parameters for that fee, and you can reprint it. But if you don't have that, you can't do it technically. We violate them a lot, and if somebody really, it's not worth people, you know, taking us to court in most instances, but they could. We just have to be sensitive to that. We weren't sensitive to that, but we're trying to be now. We have our sins forgiven, those that are known and unknown, and we're trying not to sin again. Thank you very much. I guess that means we're late.
Thank you, Darwin. We'll pick it up after lunch, and those of you who have some questions may want to talk to him personally, too.